Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 31st of August 2014. My name's T.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Paul in London, and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about Quentin Crisp, Naked Hope. This is a new show about the famous Englishman in New York by Mark Farrelly, and it's directed by Linda Marlowe. John, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
I didn't think it was Quentin Crisp, and I'm possibly one of the few members of the audience who is old enough to have met him, although not at the height of his squalor after he had achieved some fame and notoriety. He was on a book tour and came to the Nuffield Theatre in Southampton to give what is actually about half of this show as a solo monologue on stage, and then there was opportunity to meet and talk with him afterwards. And I was really, really fascinated to see Mark Farrelly's performance, to see just which elements of Crisp's personality and character he would manage to capture on stage. And of course, the one thing he misses is the appalling odour of mothballs that kind of came from the Oxfam clothing, because this, when I saw him, was in the era when Quentin was really receiving gifts from anyone and everyone and not actually purchasing anything. Just to put him in a bit of historical perspective, he was probably born in about 1910, something like that, I think, and died with the century in 1999. As a kind of artist's muse, I think he might have been. But he was on the fringes of the whole bohemian society of London and partially lived as a kind of recluse. He was, some people would say, possibly slightly crazy, but definitely eccentric to a degree, which he then cultivated. And his usefulness in the gay movement is really as a highlight and an exemplar of how not to do it. But he drew such attention that the cause became both a famous and, of course, celebre, and a cause notorious, if you like. His popularity was boosted enormously when they filmed his first collection of stories of biography, The Naked Civil Servant, with John Hurt, who I think he describes as an actor whose face matches his name, which is very good. Although in the film, his face matched Quentin's very well. A very flamboyant dresser, lots of scarves, lots of jewellery, lots of... Initially, his hair was hennaed to a very bright red, and famously he purchased, I think it was £5 of henna when war was declared, so that he'd have enough to see him through the duration. And then at the period when I saw him, he had still very long, what must have been white hair, very, very carefully coiled onto his head and coloured what Dame Edna used to call a wisteria rinse, that very sort of purpley shade of blue. He also had a very drawling and slow delivery, which I think Mark Farrelly has had to not adopt to stop the audience from falling asleep. He's had to make the delivery of the anecdotes a little bit more brisk. And in that, I think he's done a very good job. Physically, because he's quite a young actor, he must be only in his early 30s and much more physically robust than Quentin Crisp. In fact, it's worth mentioning, I have seen him before. He was in the Trafalgar Studios transfer of that Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf with slightly extraordinary casting of Matthew Kelly as George, which was really rather good. And he played Nick, the young husband who were invited to dinner by George and Martha. So it is quite a transformation. First of all, for him to be this very fey and arch character in the first half, but even more so to be the older Quentin, who he plays, quite near his death in the second half, after Quentin had moved to New York to be really much more a kind of darling of society. He was very much adopted by the rich and the famous. And I'm now trying to remember who the American actor was who spent 3 days with him in his flat in New York. Maybe someone can look that up whilst I'm... Anyway, he was very much a member of the chat show circuit, but he still lived in almost deliberate squalor on the Lower East Side, choosing the poorest and most sort of dangerous part of New York in those days, really. He lived next door to a Hell's Angels biker gang. So a man who's really, because of the number and variety of the stories that he had already written. He's a man that would be quite easy to put on stage. You don't have to add anything. And Mark Farrelly quite sensibly doesn't. This piece is cut almost entirely from, there are little scenes lifted from the Naked Civil Servant, the book and the movie, and then the second half is almost entirely taken directly from the monologue that I saw Quentin Crisp perform when he was on his book tours in the 70s. That doesn't make it bad, it makes it a little bit easy. And the thing for me that made it perhaps more easy was that this is not just some elderly actor who has found a very easy way to elongate his vowels and dress like a tramp and do this show. And had it been, I don't know, anybody even up to Derek Jacobi, you would think that was not a particularly difficult thing for a man in his 50s or 60s to do. But for a younger actor, this is quite a stretch. And it's quite good work. And it is enjoyable. I think the other thing to say, I'm analysing it quite a lot, is that it is an entertaining evening, whether or not you knew the character or knew what he was and what he represented. And I think he's done it quite well. And I'm surprised it's got a two-week residency at the St. James's. And I think it comes after a whole month he's been doing in Edinburgh. So, yeah, it's worth a look. And it's very short, I have to say. It's barely over an hour, maybe 65 minutes, something like that. Obviously no interval. And the performances are quite early there at 7 o'clock because there's another show with somebody else at 9. So very nice venue, of course. Always love the St. James's studio. Seems to suit the performance. Everybody will be able to see and hear what was going on. Quite a charming evening.
Paul, what did you think?
Well, John described quite a lot of the show in detail there, but what I would say is it does, as he said, it does pick up, I think, just from reading Crisp's biography and what he did during his life, that after The Naked Civil Servant became a hit, he did a one-man show, which the first half he talked about stories from the book, and then the second half was sort of like a question and answer and engagement with the audience. Actually, while it's true that Mark Farrelly is actually sort of channeling Quentin Crisp, and it's quite a challenge being that Crisp was, I think, a sexagenarian by the time the one-man shows were being going around in the 70s. I would have liked to...
What's wrong with being a sexagenarian?
I thought you'd say that.
That means you're 60.
But I would have thought that it would have been nice to have seen a bit more engagement with the audience, and... My observation from the night we were there was that he hadn't quite picked up the cues and how to actually deal with audience responses to his lines and quips in a way that might have been crispish, but not necessarily being in character of Quentin Crisp all the time. And I think that would have made it for an interesting show to have actually, you know, got inhibited the character so much that you knew inherently how to actually respond when your audience threw some curveballs at it. Not mentioning any names there, John. But I think it's an enjoyable show, and particularly for those that aren't exposed much to Quentin Crisp, given that he passed away at the turn of last century, but he was around for quite a long time, and he also was in plenty of films as well as television towards the later stages of his life. And he was such an inspiration for many people. It's a pity also we don't get to see any comments on the gay liberation movement, because we know exactly what his thoughts were about that, and he was quite critical of gay liberation over the years, particularly, I suspect, because they were quite critical of him. But all told, it's, as John said, it's only 70 minutes long. You get a drink, sit down at the bar, and enjoy meandering through Quentin Crisp's life, I think would be the best way to say it.
Yeah, one thing you did touch on there that I didn't mention, and I do agree with, is that there is an awful lot of familiarity of the lines, like, you know, the dust doesn't get any deeper after 4 years, and, you know, a lot of Crisperanto, I think they call it, the quotable remarks, are all there. And I wish perhaps Mark Farrelly had explored some of Quentin Crisp's nastier side, maybe, because there were causes that he took up that were not popularly adopted. He was a very fierce critic of Princess Diana, thought that she should have really stuck it out with the job and not complained about her husband's infidelity or not being terribly popular with the Queen, all that sort of thing. That you know, she took on a job that she knew what the terms and conditions were, and then he saw her kind of meltdown as a failure of character. character, and character was quite important to him. But
yeah, there's quite a lot he could have explored, actually. And you know, the dust quip I was familiar with because I had a flat share with someone a few years ago that aspired to that habit. Unfortunately, they were not as creative or interesting as Quentin Crisp, but then again, I'm not sure I would have wanted to live with Quentin Crisp either. But, no. But yes, it could have been... Could have had quite a lot of introduction to his life and his quips. But I guess, in a way, that would be a much longer show and you'd probably need a dictionary almost to fill some of them.
Yes, probably. But also his attitude to AIDS and the AIDS generation. He fell foul, as you hinted, with the Gay Liberation Front, but also the Campaign for Homosexual Equality and a lot of other organisations, because he humorised and tried to sort of diminish the AIDS epidemic as he almost treated it, I'm not sure what the word is, but he wanted to make a joke of it when too many people took it very, very seriously. I mean, he called it a fad. And he referred to homosexuality as a terrible disease. But I know that's deliberate and that's artistic style, but it did get him a lot of unpopularity. And I think a braver evening with Quentin Crisp would just touch on some of these things. You can rescue it. You can bring it back to the fact that he perhaps comes across as a little bit too cuddly.
Yeah. Yes. Although, if we are being purist and this show is meant to recreate his 70s shows, I guess we can get him off the hook for AIDS.
We're now going to talk about Toast. This is Richard Bean's 1990 play, first done at the Royal Court and directed by Richard Wilson. It was an interesting play when I first saw it, because it brought to mind that this was certainly a playwright to watch, although I don't think I saw his next play until about 4 years later. But he certainly has been a playwright to watch, Richard Bean. He's almost, very nearly, he's certainly going to have three plays on at the same time in London later in September. And if he'd managed to keep it going for another month, there's something else opening in November. So he's got Meg Dagnam, which he wrote the book for in November, but he's got Great Britain and Great Britain Pickhead and, of course, Toast here at the Park Theatre. This is being done by Snapdragon Theatre Productions, and this particular production is directed by Eleanor Rode and features Steve Nicholson, Will Barton, Matt Sutton, Simon Greenhall, Matthew Kelly, Finlay Robertson and John Walk. The play is about a Hull bakery plot. It makes thousands of loaves every night. Some of the numbers they were banding about, you always get to about 10,000 loaves by the end of it. And it's fairly successful, but it's very, very old. We have one character has been there for 40 years as a mixer, a taciturn mixer, and he's played by Matthew Kelly. But it seems to run itself, and it seems to be quite a good plant. But, of course, if anything breaks down, they're going to close it. And that's a threat that's within this play. But really, what the first half of this play is the character. We get introduced to all the people who work in the bakery. I mean, the main character really is a character called Blakey. He's an ex-con, but he's an extremely capable charge hand. This is the person who is pretty much in charge of the whole bakery operation, but not actually a manager. He's very much part of the workforce. And part of the plot is that he's trying to get a job at the slightly bigger plant in Bradford, which may replace this one at some point in the future. But it's rather important for everybody else that this particular plant stays open, although they all know it's under threat. I mean, it is really built up on these very strong characters that Richard Bean makes, and it is extremely well done. I mean, as I said, in 1999, he really did point him out as a potentially successful playwright, and he is possibly the most successful British playwright at the moment, especially, as I said, with the three or even four plays that he's got on this year. So he's certainly always worth watching, and this not only shows a great deal of promise, it also proves that he's very well worth watching. And this production is very well worth watching. It's got lots of good people in it. It's perhaps a little bit too slow in the first half, I thought, but the second half, where we start getting what is almost a thriller plot in there, and it becomes much more plot heavy, having introduced all the characters in the first half, it works really well. Gareth, what did you think about it?
Well, as you say, Richard Bean is a very prolific playwright, and in the 15 years since this was put on, I counted that he'd done 16 plays and 2 adaptations, which is an extraordinarily productive period for a man who came to playwriting perhaps a little later than some. And I haven't seen all of those, but I've seen a lot of them. And a big feature, I think, of Richard Bean is the diversity. I mean, he does write all sorts of different things. So he moves from a sort of satire on the press, the media and the police in Great Britain, on to a play about the mutiny of the Bounty, and then on to an adaptation of Maid in Dagenham about the striking women in Dagenham. So he's a writer that turns his hand to all sorts of things. And I think it's really interesting now to look back at what was his first professionally produced play, because I think it's, you know, we now have that body of work and we can look back at where he started. And he started by writing about his own experiences, because he worked in a bakery like this when he was 18, I guess, before university. And it's clear that these people are real to him. You know, they are very, very vividly drawn characters, and the situations are very real. There's a sort of naturalism and realism running right through this piece. And I think the great strength of the writing is the characterization. I think that's the great strength of the writing. I have a few problems with the production. Like you, I found the pacing too slow, particularly the sort of achingly slow start to it, and most of the first half just doesn't really have enough pace to it. The other problem I have with it is that I felt the interval kind of got in the way of the flow of the one night shift that we're witnessing. And I think if you cut out the interval, you know, you wouldn't have a play that's much more than about an hour and 40 minutes. And I think my recollection is, when it was at the Theatre Royal upstairs in 1999, it was without interval. And I sort of felt the interval, for me, got in the way this time. And I think the other thing about it is, even though it takes place over a whole night shift, there are no scene breaks. I think you said that there were scene breaks in the Theatre Royal upstairs. There are no scene breaks here. And we know we start the first half at 10 to 3 from the clock, and we know we start the second half at 10 p.m. from the clock. But it's not in real time, so a lot of things happen, but you don't really know the intervals between them. And I felt there should have been some way of kind of marking that, you know, perhaps, you know, just the clock changing or something like that. I thought that would have been better. But, you know, that said, in addition to in addition to looking back at a major playwright's new work, and I really do think he is a major playwright, I think it's also a fantastic set of performances. I mean, I thought they were all excellent, all 7 of them, and the acting was superb. And I think this is the Park Theatre being indispensable again, reviving something like this that, you know, is well worth seeing now, 15 years on, and giving it a set of performances that a lot of theatres would die to have. So I would recommend going to see it, despite the sort of the few comments on the pacing of the production, because I think its time has come to kind of look back and see it again.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.